Today on Against the Grain. A century ago, out of the carnage of World War I and the wave of revolutions that swept Europe, came an artistic movement that put personal and societal liberation at its center, Surrealism. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll be joined by one of the later members of the Surrealist movement, Penelope Rosemont, to discuss the art and politics of Surrealism and her own particular history within and beyond it. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Surrealist movement jarred the worlds of established art and politics when it first flowered in the decades following World War I. Now roughly 100 years old, Surrealism still speaks to our desires for liberation. In Surrealism, Inside the Magnetic Fields, Penelope Rosemont reflects on some of the central figures of the movement, such as Leonora Carrington, Man Ray, Toyen, and André Breton. And she also writes about her own life within Surrealism and radical politics as a poet and artist, a young member of the Industrial Workers of the World, and a publisher of left-wing literature in Chicago. Rosemont is the editor of the seminal Surrealist Women, an international anthology, and the author of many books, including Lost Worlds, Forgotten Futures, Undreamed Ecstasies. The term surrealism is so commonplace, Penelope, that it may not appear to merit a definition at all. Nonetheless, could you take a stab at what it means?
Well, today people tend to use it as the bizarre, a new word for the bizarre, but that's really not correct because it was coined by Apollinaire and then established as a movement in 1924. And this year, of course, we're celebrating what's considered the first surrealist text, The Magnetic Fields, between Breton and Supault, which was an automatic text that was published in Literature. And then also in, you know, next year it was published as a book. The interesting thing was that, of course, it was the end of the First World War, and people were demobilized. And at the beginning of 1919, Breton's best friend, Jacques Vachet, committed suicide. And so when he and Supault were writing these texts, there's a lot of feeling that goes into it, and a lot of confusion and a lot of dream. And it is an automatic text, and yet it's very moving. So you know, it was a very unusual year for Breton and many of the surrealists who were getting out of World War I, having been deeply affected by what they thought proved that Western civilization was a total failure. So surrealism, coined by Apollinaire, meant, you know, greater than realism or more than our current realism. And for Breton, he sort of defined it in the way that you might say, it was, a conjunction of things that came into the mind. It was an exploration of the mind. It was a very complex thing for them, but it was invented at a specific period in time with a specific contribution they wanted to make. So, and it was a idea of liberation, not necessarily just the bizarre. They really wanted to change society. And so surrealism means something quite different for me. It's almost a school of philosophy rather than simply the bizarre.
You mentioned that it came out of a particular time, and I wanted to ask you more about those times, including the year 1919, which was a remarkable year. As you mentioned, people were being demobilized from World War I and experienced the horror of that war. A wave of revolution broke out following World War I. at the same time, it was a time where artistic avant-gardes were deeply involved in grappling with art and the world. What would you say was so significant about that confluence of things for the emergence of surrealism?
Well, even there was more of a confluence also because just a few years previously in that year, I mean, Einstein was making headlines because of his discovery of general relativity and such. And they were watching the eclipse. Eddington was watching the eclipses to check out how the light was bent and such. So there were many scientific discoveries. Freud was trying to map the mind in a way that would be understandable and comprehensible. And they were looking into mental illness. And of course, the Surrealists were very interested in what mental illness meant. Some of their first experiments were in hypnosis and in trying to provoke the feeling of mental illness in themselves so that they would understand it better. And Dali actually came up probably somewhat later with a method that was called a paranoid critical method, in which he would look at a photograph or a painting and look for the details in it and sort of interpret through the details. And it was really a very effective way of looking at things. So surrealism started out in poetry. It was just a position of unusual words that were to provoke images. But then Breton wrote a book, Surrealism in Painting, which talked about painters who were involved in surrealism and all that. And pretty soon the image traveled almost faster than the poetry, which of course was in French. And so surrealism was known worldwide. By 1926, there was a surrealist exhibition in Japan. So, you know, this is 2 years after the founding of surrealism, basically.
What was the importance of cinema for the surrealists?
Well, that was interesting because it was the very beginnings of cinema. And they loved to go to the cinema. They had their own way of interpreting it. They would go from one movie house to another and just see a portion of the film and so that it would be more dreamlike for them. But probably when Breton was 15, I think the Fantomas series, the Mastermind Criminal, was out and about in film. And that was a series of cliffhangers. It was originally a series of novels that were put together by two people working together, writing chapters alternatively with the same characters. So it was sort of a surrealist method of putting together a novel. But then, about the time of toward the end of the war, the vampires, Louis Fias, Le Vampires came out, starring Musa Dora, who was the hero villainess of it all. And it was a gang of robbers who would go around and doing spectacular robberies and spectacular getaways in their automobile, which was a new thing for both thieves and cinema. So the auto chase was invented then. So the surrealism and the cinema really developed together. And some of the really great things that we know about cinema today are, well, from Louis Buñuel and Dali. And Buñuel went on to make many surrealist movies. And in fact, so much of film today uses surrealist imagery that, you know, it's hard to separate this from what the movement does, but there still is a group of people who consider themselves surrealists.
I wanted to ask you about a figure who you write about in your book, Surrealism Inside the Magnetic Fields, which is Gustav Landauer. He was an anarchist and a participant in one of the uprisings that took place after,
in Munich. Yes.
In Munich, and in fact, establishing the short-lived Munich Soviet. What does he represent, and how does he sort of shed light on the larger questions the Surrealists were grappling with.
Well, he is sometimes called a philosopher of play, which is odd since, you know, he got involved in the Munich uprising and, you know, he was killed because of it. But he had a relatively joyful idea that people should participate, that, you know, work should be transformed more into play, that play should become more of daily life, and that education, especially, he was a philosopher of education, could be done more through play than through severe discipline, which, of course, this is Germany and they believed in discipline everyone. So, I particularly loved Gustav Landauer, and I read a book that came out at that time called Prophet of Community.
We'll talk about the philosophy that was drawn on by the Surrealists. The Surrealists were divided in terms of where they took their politics to, some to anarchism, some to Trotskyism, some to left communism. But what was the importance of Marxism and Hegelianism to their thinking about the world?
Well, there was an interpreter of Hegel called Koyev, whose book was available in France, and that is what they read, and they were quite influenced by Hegel and his philosophy. Now, most of them did straight out join the Communist Party, but I think it was about 1930 that they were denounced as being degenerates by Ilya Ehrenberg.
He was a leading Soviet intellectual.
And this is about the time Stalin is taking over. And so there was a conference in Paris, and Breton happened to see Ilya Ehrenberg as he was crossing the street. So he got out his cane and he socked him a couple of times in the head. Now, needless to say, the conference was supposed to be that night or very much after it, and the Surrealists were supposed to be participating in the conference, but I think they saved their session for 1 a.m. or something when everyone else was gone. And so they did definitely split with Stalinism. They did not believe in socialist realism, and they did not like what was going on in the Soviet Union, which was virtually becoming a dictatorship. Unfortunately, René Crevel, who was a homosexual and a communist, committed suicide also. He was he felt that somehow, you know, this was his fault. So anyway, it was a very sad time for the Surrealists. But they kept up their faith that there should be some sort of political commitment. And they'd always put out their own manifestos, their own interpretation of things. And, you know, I'd say 99.9% of the time, they were right on. They really put out great manifestos. So they put out something in defense of Germaine Breton, who was an anarchist assassin. She assassinated one of the Alliance Française generals. And he was such an unpopular person and such a fascist that when she went to trial, she was acquitted. So you can see that it was, the Surrealists were supported in that. And they supported Violette Nozière. Now, she attempted to kill her parents, and she was denounced as being a mindless flapper. And the Surrealists defended her, they were about the only people that defended her. It turns out there's been a book written on her recently that says that she was probably sexually abused by her father. And interestingly, she went to prison for many years rather than being executed. When she got out of prison, she married. Her mother moved in with her, and, you know, she just led a normal life. So, you know, it was just one of those things where she was driven to that particular act. And I think the Surrealists were correct in defending her. But they also defended the Papin sisters. And so, you see, even though there were women in the Surrealist movement and they were being creative, some of them were being creative in terms of paintings. In my book, Surrealist Women, from the early days, I found a lot of little automatic texts by women. But, you know, I think that they themselves were a little hesitant in terms of their contributions. I don't think it was necessarily that they were censored by the Surrealists, but they were self-censoring themselves. They were just too careful. And also, you know, I would imagine that, you know, as time went on, their ideas developed, and hopefully maybe we'll find some manuscripts yet.
I'm speaking with artist, historian, and social activist Penelope Rosemont. This is Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. And we're talking today about surrealism. Penelope is, among other things, the editor of this seminal work, Surrealist Women. So let me ask you more about women in the Surrealist movement. The figures that dominated the movement in its early days were men, and André Breton obviously was a charismatic and important figure. And yet there was a real interest in the psyches of women as part of surrealism. How do you understand that dimension, and who of the early surrealists who were women do you think we should sort of recover and think about when we're thinking about this movement?
When I was working on my book, of course, I really enjoyed Claude Cahun. Now, she is working about the time of the Second World War. She wrote quite a bit of texts and was active in the Surrealist movement. Breton liked her work very much. She moved off to a Channel Island during World War II, and there she started a little self-activity that was anti-fascist with her companion Suzanne. And they would put little notes in cigarette papers and in various places telling the German troops to revolt and to get rid of their officers. So eventually they were tracked down, and it was discovered it was these two middle-aged ladies who were offering a resistance in World War II, and they were sentenced to death. And of course, they were going to be brought to Berlin for a big show, trial, execution sort of thing. But the war ended, and, you know, that intervened. Now, a lot of Claude's wonderful photography and writings have become available, and I am surprised at the amount of it there is. Some of it is actually in English. And I find her work very inspiring. Now, of course, there's Nancy Kennard, who many people don't think of as being a surrealist.
Mm-hmm. And who you write about in your book.
I do write about in my book. Now, the thing that she was a relatively wealthy person, she spent her money establishing her own printing press, which, considering do-it-yourself printing, that may have not been the easiest thing, because people think printing is easier than it really is. But she did establish her own press and published many important books. And then with Henry Crowder, a jazz musician, she put together the Negro Anthology, which has quite a few surrealist writers in it and was a very important book at that particular period. It turned out it's a fairly rare book, so you don't see it that often, although there have been reprints. But I thought she was very important in the surrealist milieu and as a surrealist. And while she didn't write herself, she understood the importance of publication and language. So I like to think of her. Then, of course, Leonora Carrington and Toyen have been very important to me, and Mimi Perrant, who is part of the later group. So, you know, I'm not really sure there's so many women that did fabulous things.
Do you think that surrealism has a politics inherent to it? I mean, you described it early in the program as not simply about, you know, the reductionist notion about the bizarre or juxtaposing things that are unexpected, but that it's also about liberation. And most of the people involved with surrealism were firmly on the left and very engaged as radicals. But then you also had people like Salvador Dali, who ended up supporting the Spanish dictator Franco and was, I think, essentially a fascist. How do you understand the inherent politics of surrealism?
Well, they did expel Salvador Dali. So, and they expelled a few people over the years. Mostly, it was the right thing to do. So it's odd for a group of artists to expel people, but they did. They took themselves seriously. So, basically, they were for sexual liberation, human liberation in all its forms. They really thought that it was necessary to be politically active in an anti-racist and anti-religious way. So, basically, that covers a lot. Now, in terms of their own political persuasions, they went through various developments, sometimes together, sometimes not. They fought the fascists when they were there. Some of them were in the resistance. Some of them had to flee to New York. But they were active in their groups. Breton and Trotsky put together a manifesto. But Breton did not stay with Trotskyism. They were exploring Charles Fourier about the time I got there in 1965, and they had an exhibition, L'Écart Absolu.
This is about the utopian socialist.
Yeah, about Charles Fourier. So that was good. So they were exploring all sorts of political possibilities, and basically, you know, Benjamin Perret had been in the POUM in Spain. And
this is the group that was associated with the Trotskyists.
And so Breton never was. Breton ended up in New York with his wife and child. He had been remobilized in World War II or rejoined. I don't know, could have been rejoined. He was in the medical corps. So, and then he got out and they fled from Marseille. And they fled through the Caribbean. And in one of the islands there, they discovered the Légitime Défense group. They discovered the magazine Tropiques that M.A. Césaire and Suzanne Césaire edited. So they were just so pleased to find a surrealist journal in the Caribbean in these dark days of the war. So basically... They have had a very good philosophy, and I think that it actually hasn't been a mistake to work in all those different political areas and be able to get along with each other, because that's one of the things we need to do. We need to say that there might not necessarily be one right path. There's plenty of ways to work in the same direction. And, you know, different people do different things. Some people write, some people make films. There's all different areas that we really have to explore and make the vehicle for liberation rather than enslavement, as somehow the internet seems to be going now.
Well, you touched on a moment ago surrealism in the Caribbean, and I wanted to ask you about the degree to which surrealism really became a global movement and an anti-colonial one. Obviously, Paris was its center, but artists around the world embraced surrealism and made it their own.
Yeah, well, there's been surrealist groups in almost every place in the world. There's even been an Arab surrealist group, and the fact that it survived is kind of a miracle. Of course, they're living in Paris. They wouldn't probably have been able to survive in any of the countries that they were born in. But they supported anti-imperialism from the time they opposed the colonial exhibition in France. Oh, probably back in the 1930s, they had a counter-exhibition and they also put out a manifesto.
Tell us about the importance of André Breton, who died in 1966. To what degree was the movement deeply enmeshed with him as a character, and to what degree was it wider than him?
I knew him, of course, as a grand sort of highly respected person, very, very polite, very poetic, very kind. And he knew how to run a group. He really did. Of course, he'd had maybe 40, 50 years of figuring out how to do it. So, he would come not too frequently to the cafe, which met virtually every night. So maybe he'd come every week or so, particularly in the winter, and we were there in the winter. And he would be sure to ask everyone what their project was. And everybody had a project. That was the interesting thing about this group. I have a feeling that if you couldn't come up with a project, you didn't come. So it ran rather smoothly while he was around. And I have to say that my friend Mimi Perrant did a great job of running it also. She was a very active influence. She was there all the time. She was one of the first persons there, and she was friendly and congenial with everyone and got everyone to cooperate. Now, of course, Breton died later the same year, and that wasn't too much of a crisis for the group. But the crisis was 1968. So when that came round, of course...
This is the great upheaval in Paris.
Yes,
in
this is the great upheaval in Paris. When that came around, the Surrealists, of course, wanted to be active. And some of them did. They went off to the barricades, including Elisa Breton. But they found out when they came back to their cafe that it was often surrounded by hundreds of people who wanted to know, they wanted the advice of the Surrealists. Like, so because they didn't know what to do exactly. Well, the Surrealists actually hadn't planned any political uprising, so they were poets, and they began to split as people came up with differing ideas about what should be done. So I do believe that caused a split at that particular moment. Now, of course, the Situationists get a lot of credit for the 1968 uprising, and they definitely deserve it. But it was Surrealist slogans on the walls. Surrealists even made up some of the slogans on the walls. I think it was Gerard Legrand made up the one, "Imagination must be all," or something like that. And in fact, us Surrealists in Chicago had come up with the slogan, "Make Love, Not War," in 1965. So we were very into encouraging people to take to the streets and to influence the politics of their time. And in fact, the 68 people did influence the politics of their time, for better and for worse, I'm sure. So, now they have redone Paris so that it's even harder to pull up the paving stones. So, it's not as easy. But at that time, I think they got rid of some politicians that were quite terrible and replaced them with some that are better, and they probably need to do that again. In fact, all of the politicians worldwide seem to be thinking that this is a good time for them to take back many of the things that the people have won over the years.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Penelope Rosemont. She has been a member of the Surrealist movement for many decades and is the author of Surrealism Inside the Magnetic Fields, published by City Lights at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. Her many other books include Make Love, Not War, Surrealism, 1968. Well, let me ask you about your own involvement in Surrealism. You were talking about being in Paris in 1965 and meeting André Breton, but what was your first encounter with Surrealism?
I do believe it was a little reader's companion to world literature. Somehow I was reading through it and I got to the Paul Elouard section and I came upon Elephants Must Be Contagious. And I thought that somehow that really struck my funny bone. So I really, really, really liked that. And I told all my friends at high school. There weren't too many of my friends, but they passed it on. And pretty soon there was a lot of giggling in class as people passed on little notes that said elephants are contagious. So it was a lot of fun, but I had no idea that surrealism still existed. When I transferred over to Roosevelt University, I found a group of people who called themselves the Anti-Poetry Club at that time, and they were sponsored by John Bracey Jr., who is an African-American and later wrote on the African-American civil rights movement. So anyway, John sponsored the Anti-Poetry Club, and they had somehow decided, a couple of them, that they wanted to find Leonora Carrington. So they went to Mexico, hitchhiking all the way. And when they got there, they ultimately found Leonora Carrington, but she gave them some clues about surrealists in New York. That was Claude Tarnot, who actually was a translator for the United Nations. And Tarnot was in touch with Breton and the existing surrealist group in France. And so he wrote to them and let them know that some young people were looking for the group. So they were actually publishing a magazine at that time. And we got copies of the magazine. So we were very pleased to have that and began a correspondence with André Breton through Robert Benayoun, who edited a film magazine named Positif. He also wrote a wonderful book on film. But since we had this correspondence, we knew that there were actually surrealists in the world. And Tarnot had taken the friends over to Gotham Bookmart in New York, which stocked tons of surrealist books in French. So they brought back a lot of books. They had a lot of things. And then ultimately, about 1965, we thought we would go to England and visit the anarchists there at Freedom Press and visit some of the radicals in England and see London. And then we would stop briefly in Paris and say hello to the surrealists. So it was very interesting when we got to Heathrow Airport. For some reason, they didn't like us, they thought. And the question was, we think you are trying to immigrate to England. No, we're not. We're just passing through. So, but they weren't convinced. And so they were going to send us back to the U.S., but I negotiated deporting us to Paris. So they deported us to Paris, which was very fine, except we arrived on December 24th and had no place to stay. But it was pretty amusing, you know, wandering around in Paris trying to find a place to stay on Christmas Eve. But we did. And then we also noticed that there was in all of the bookstore windows, there was the reprint of André Breton's Surrealism in Painting. And there was next to it a poster that said Le Carré Absolu for the Surrealist exhibition they were holding currently. So we went over to the exhibition and we asked about Robert Benayoun, who is our correspondent, and all. They said, oh, yes, he comes in every day. So we got in touch with him, basically, and he put us in touch with the group who was meeting daily. So that was very fortunate. It was a lot colder in Paris than I expected. And so it was good to get out to the cafe to meet with people every evening. Otherwise, we tried to stay well and do some writing and thinking. And we stayed for about 5 months. And then we finally got to England, and we finally got to Freedom Press. And that was also very nice. We met Charles Radcliffe, and we put out a little issue, a magazine, in London. He later became a Situationist.
Tell us about your own politics and sort of political formation in Chicago, what you were involved in and how surrealism intersected with that.
Well, it started out that I was anti-war. In high school, I'd been very interested in science, and I still am very interested in science. So when I heard there was a civil defense class on, nuclear weapons, I decided I would sign up for this. Well, it was relatively terrifying. So I decided that nuclear war, nobody would win. And so I became an anti-war activist. I joined the Student Peace Union, which was centered in Hyde Park around the University of Chicago. I went on a demonstration with them to Washington. Well, it was about 1962, I think. And then I was part of a club there at my college called the Jacobin Club. My friend Carol Travis and Michael James, who stayed with politics this whole time in slightly different aspects of it, were also part of the club. And then when I transferred, I wanted to go to Chicago, wanted to see what Chicago was like. When I transferred to Roosevelt University, I was surprised that it was a hotbed of politics, literally. So there, every table had a different faction of something at it. And I thought, this is a much more political period of time in history than I thought. So I was very happy that I met these people who were interested in surrealism, and they were also interested in the industrial workers of the world, more or less historically, because it was such an Americanly based union and syndicalist union. It had such a wonderful background in activity and folk music, and generally there were some of them still alive, and they were not far from the place we had sort of settled at Halstead and Armitage Avenue. So they had an office there. So I met Carlos Cortez there, who later became a magnificent graphic artist, did these wonderful woodcuts that are at the Smithsonian and all. And Fred Thompson, a fantastic labor historian, and a lot of other people. So I met them all. But as kids, we are thinking, well, what can we possibly do? We have to have some place to live. And so the idea came up to start a bookstore. We started a bookstore on Armitage Avenue, and I think this is such a, the do-it-yourself idea of how are you going to do politics. So we got a nice storefront. We built a loft there, and we got all of the books from our parents' basements and closets and everything and built bookshelves, and it was mostly used. But at that time, there were certain books that we thought were pretty significant that you couldn't get. And we got them from Freedom Press. We got Wilhelm Reich, and, we had Brave New World and all sorts of utopian novels. And we also stocked some other things from Freedom Press. We stocked New Directions and City Lights. So we had both new books in avant-garde and political. Turns out that Barbara's bookstore, not too far away, was also a very magnificent bookstore, and eventually some of us got jobs there. So Barbara's bookstore also got City Lights books and things like that. Oh, we did also stock Arkham House books, which are great science fiction books. And actually, they were the first publishers of Lovecraft, who is now available amazingly at Barnes & Noble. So it was an idea of education to have a bookstore And a radio station might have been a good idea, too, but we went in for books.
Penelope Rosemont is my guest, longtime surrealist and author of many books, most recently Surrealism Inside the Magnetic Fields. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were in the 1960s involved with the International Workers of the World, this historic organization, and of course Chicago has a long history of radicalism and labor radicalism. And you also became involved with surrealism. Tell us about the publication Rebel Worker.
Well, it was mimeographed, which is pretty humorous since apparently some people have been looking into mimeograph. They call it the mimeo revolution. So there are some exhibitions actually out there in the world. There was one in London which had mimeographed publications on display, which seems so funny. But it is a way of printing leaflets and printing a journal that's quite easy. Not quite as easy as Xeroxing, but that led to a whole variety of zines, which is a nice thing. But it was cheap. It was popular. Postage was cheap. We would do 1,000 or maybe even 2,000 copies of our magazine and sell them all. So it was nice. It worked well. You know, there were some surrealist things in there and some labor history things in there. And the first thing I wrote, which maybe was for Rebel Worker number 2, I think, was Berkeley was only the beginning, and it was on the strike here in Berkeley.
What was the significance of the urban rebellions that took place, the Watts Riot in 1965 being one of them, for the Surrealist movement?
Well, we tended to defend the people who were involved. We knew the Black Panthers in Chicago somewhat. And, you know, I was on the West Side when the Martin Luther King rebellions happened after Martin Luther King's assassination. And, of course, you know, it was shocking that King was assassinated. There had to be some response to it. The people couldn't just pass up that. So, you know, I was working at SDS at the time and was glad to see people out. It was not dangerous for anyone that I knew of. You know, we just had friends who were sort of hoping that maybe things would change seriously, that people would wake up when they saw that this was going on. But often this leads to just more police. And you know, I just wish that the civil rights movement could have had more victories than it did have, because now we're getting a pushback from a really powerful and wealthy right wing. And so I don't really know quite what we're going to do now.
How do you connect the spread or the continuation of the Surrealist movement by people in Chicago, obviously, as you've described, with close links to the international movement, to what was going on in France, and the connection to earlier surrealisms in the United States? Did you feel like you were part of a longer lineage? You write about Joseph Cornell in your book, Surrealism Inside the Magnetic Fields, as one artist in that surrealist tradition.
Well, no, in a sense, because when the Surrealists were here in New York fleeing from fascism, they really weren't very organized. They were organized enough to put together a show, or Peggy Guggenheim put together a show for them. Breton was actually doing Voice of America programs for France.
Really?
Yeah, he was doing the newscast, and that was his job. He didn't have any other job. He's trying to support his family on that. So they met, but on the other hand, they really weren't organized as a group. They really wanted to get back to their home countries and, you know, be part of that. So Dolly, of course, did go to Los Angeles and all that, and he stayed here. But the French mostly felt at home in Paris, and they felt that that was the place they could make a difference. So while there was a little bit of Surrealist activity here, there was Julian Levy had a gallery also. It was mostly in the arts. And Cornell, of course, made these wonderful object boxes. He was a relatively reclusive and shy person, but he made wonderful object boxes. So we consider ourselves relatively the first Surrealist group that was actually a Surrealist group in the U.S.
One of the threads that runs through your book, Surrealism Inside the Magnetic Fields, and through your life, and certainly through the Surrealist movement as well, is a abiding interest in keeping ideas alive through publications and publishing. So I wanted to ask you about your history since the 60s and since the efforts that you've been describing, such as Rebel Worker, in keeping the flame of Surrealism alive through publishing.
Well, I don't know, maybe either it's because of Hegel or something I inherited or whatever, but we do think history is important. And so I've been involved, or I was involved with the Charles H. Kerr Company for many years. And one of the things we're most proud of there, which is just not Surrealist, was the Haymarket scrapbook, which sort of commemorated the anarchists who were involved in the labor movement at that time, fighting for the 8-hour day, who were executed in Chicago. That was something that we were really happy that we did, and it may still be available through AK Press. So then we went on and published a lot of other books that we thought would be helpful to people. We published something called Harlem Glory, which is by Claude McKay, and it was the first publication of it. But somehow or another,
this is a writer associated with the Harlem Renaissance and yeah, also the radical left.
Yeah. Somehow or another, that has not really, it really didn't get the credit it deserved, perhaps because it is magnificently anti-religious. But anyway, so if we don't remember something, nobody is going to remember it, because most of the powers that be in this country are going to remember the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers. They might add, the people around Microsoft or something, but they're never going to remember what I think is the most interesting part of our history, the fact that individuals made real contributions all the time, and the fact that history doesn't develop, at the top. It actually develops throughout the society, many, many magnificent contributions by people. So, we've always been interested in publishing things. I would like to mention that we had a little series with the University of Texas Press, which published Surrealist Women, and it also published a book by Michael Lowy called Morning Star, which was excellent in terms of some of the political and artistic essays that he put together. So, it's just Surrealism goes on. If it doesn't go on as an organized movement, which I hope it does, because you can do more as a relatively small group. I believe in the small affinity group. You get together, you meet, you come up with ideas, you do things together, you help each other out, you have discussions.
Do you think that it's important for those who are involved in radical politics or on the left today that they also involve themselves with culture, and that culture is part of that wider struggle?
Well, culture is definitely part of the wider struggle. Whether people on the left should involve themselves in it is another question, because they tend to think about it very practically. And that may not, that may be end up to be more propaganda No, sure. That can be good in a way. You know, you have to have some sort of way to get out ideas, and visual ways are as good as any other. But I think that surrealism is unique in the way that it approaches things. So I really can't say. I should hope that they'll definitely be involved in culture on some level and think about how it affects other things. But I really don't know how it should interact. Surrealism is kind of a special thing for me. And while, you know, I enjoy being part of the left movement also, I've sort of always separated them in my mind somehow.
Do you feel like the flame of surrealism still burns? Do you see younger artists, writers engaging with surrealism?
Well, this is certainly true. Now, sometimes they're relatively isolated. In fact, I'm going to be talking in Chicago at an Ishida show, Tatsuo Ishida. And he is an incredible critique of society in his paintings, you know, of the repressive roles that people are assigned and trapped in. He's wonderful. Of course, unfortunately, he committed suicide. But, you know, as far as I know, he was acting in isolation, even though there is a long history of surrealism in Japan. I don't know that he was in touch with other surrealists there. But I just can't believe that the critique that surrealism has of society and the hopes that it has for society can go away. In fact, if you look at the cover of my book, which is by Leonora Carrington, you will see it's really a very amusing, hopeful cover. And so we have that both. We have a really stern critique of society, and we have the hopeful aspects and the utopian and the play aspect that surrealism emphasizes.
And you can see the cover of the book if you go to againstthegrain.org, where you'll find a link to Surrealism Inside the Magnetic Fields, published by City Lights. Penelope Rosemont, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sasha.
I've been speaking with the artist, historian, social activist, and longtime surrealist, Penelope Rosemont. She is the author of many books, including Make Love, Not War, Surrealism 1968, and editor of Surrealist Women, an international anthology. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.